Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
This month at postwrestlingcafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. postwrestlingcafe.com. $6 gets you in the door.
Here's a sample of a free podcast from the Post Wrestling Cafe. $6 gets you through the door at postwrestlingcafe.com.
How over are we right now, Billy? How long?
1:45.
On his shoulders, looking for the go to sleep. He connects with Punk's finishing move, the GTS.
Come on, man. We got to go.
From producers to writers to talent, everybody has to be able to edit on the spot.
If I was going to cut anything, I would cut the Anaconda Vice out.
Sorry, Bruce.
I'm pushing him, Bruce. Help get Punk to his feet. Bruce, I'm sorry we went over. No, it was 2.5. But we cut out a bunch of shit. We cut out the Anaconda Vice. And
it was overwritten. It was overproduced. It was over everything else. It's fine. It was a great show.
Yes, sir. Is he mad at me?
No. You'd be happy with yourself.
I am.
Right.
Yeah. Hello, everybody. Check your reality at the door, because it's time to get unreal with John Pollock and Wei Ting.
Check your reality at the door.
There's nothing real happening. It's unreal.
Yeah, right. You know, that could have been on the show poster.
What do you think the options were for other titles? Like unfake?
Something to do with that, I guess. I mean, at this point, in order to come up with a title for this, we know who this show is trying to appeal to. It's trying to appeal to the wrestling fan who's not usually, actually, people who aren't wrestling fans, period. And what is the first thing? Like, we have to get into the mindset of what the first thing comes to mind for somebody who doesn't watch wrestling.
Yeah, I mean, you know, certainly the rhyming scheme of Drive to Survive, that was a nice one. A little tougher with, sports entertain, no, to others disdain. I don't know if that would have I think so little of titles, so I don't put too much thought into this other than that came to mind right as the live flashed in front of me here. How are you, Wei?
Doing all right. Yep, not so bad. Watch this episode right before we recorded this.
As is usual, Wei typically just, I think there's a benefit to this. Like, you usually wait right up until the end to get your viewing done. Sometimes I will get too ahead of myself and then I forget about stuff that I have to go check back. That was not the case with Unreal. These episodes, when people are listening to this, these episodes have been out for a week. There was zero time last week for either of us to sit down and watch these. And it was kind of interesting that I sensed, like, online, of course, there was a lot of buzz on the Tuesday, and there's clips circulating and a discussion. Wavered off Wednesday, and I honestly have to say, again, very anecdotal from my own perspective, but someone that is online and focusing on this, by Thursday, it felt like everyone had moved on from this series, kind of. Like, I think that's sort of the blessing and the curse of this binge style of dropping all these episodes. Like, if it's a massive hit, you're relying on word of mouth to carry this, that everyone has to see this. And if it doesn't, it's like you don't have next week's episode to re-engage that audience. So it's going to depend ultimately on the substance of the series. And I would say just overall, and again, you and I have only seen the first two episodes as we're speaking. Mm-hmm. It sounds to me as though, you know, big buzz. I don't know if this one has necessarily permeated that far outside of wrestling fans. But again, this might be a series that, like, a month down the road, we hear, you know, people that go back and they'll check this out eventually. But that's my overall opinion, like a week after these episodes dropped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. I think the timing of release for this is maybe an interesting topic to discuss on its own. I think certainly on the surface, it makes a lot of sense. It's a lead up to SummerSlam, you know, of this period in the calendar year. It might be the biggest sort of like week, because that is the biggest event of this part of the calendar year to debut something like this. But I do also feel like that kind of worked against it, in my opinion, because so much of the conversation, at least among the wrestling audience, is about SummerSlam. And this almost felt like it was something that was just like...
And there was also like the tail end of the Hogan stuff, too. Like, that's mm-hmm. where the media was focused on. That's where a lot of fans were focused on. They were still doing like a tribute for Hogan on the Monday night going into Tuesday.
Yeah.
Like, that's just the reality. Like, there is so much content being produced that I think it's harder and harder for stuff like this to stand out in a meaningful way. Mm-hmm. But I think generally, like, if you're a fan of WWE, you would have been drawn to at least sample this series and check it out. But did this cross over and have the full Netflix effect? It's hard to say a week in, but it didn't feel like it last week.
Well, the other part of this conversation is, does it matter whether or not it's appealing to the actual wrestling fan? Because this series, very much like, you know, I think the conversation, or at least its attempt to replicate the success of a Drive to Survive for F1, is very much catered to the fan that is not currently a WWE fan. So how much wrestling is that person consuming? And is that person being swept up necessarily by the conversation or hype surrounding SummerSlam enough to not give this, you know, the attention? This is catered to the person flicking through Netflix who might be wanting to watch anything, you know, like whether it be a reality show or documentary, and then being somewhat curious about this. And in that sense, I do think the timing leading up to SummerSlam makes a lot of sense.
There's nothing better than your... you know, you're binging the Mr. McMahon series, and after learning about Rita Chatterton, you also might like this.
Pretty much. It's a bit of a weird one, too. But this, I would say, the closest thing on Netflix to this is Mr. McMahon. So I would entirely think that this would be, you know, the type of follow-up.
You bring up a point I just want to raise because of the fact of, you know, is this just servicing an audience that is already there? And I would compare it as well to this recent decision of WWE dropping these press conferences, and people can have a lot of thoughts about that. And I don't doubt part of it in WWE is the fact that these outlets that are being credentialed to go to these press conferences, these are the sites that are going to be writing about WWE regardless. It's very similar to UFC, where like all of your MMA sites, like, they are going to be covering you daily anyway. So what is... like, who are we reaching with these necessarily? Who are we opening?
Well, they're getting a lot of non, like they're quote-unquote mainstream, you know, media were attending these press conferences as well. But like,
maybe for like a Mania, but I don't know how significant like the mainstream, like, you do have right. like entertainment sites and stuff like that.
Especially in the case of this past weekend, they would have received more bad press. Even on the mainstream, you're only like, let's say a question about Donald Trump or Brock Lesnar were to be brought up, they would only be inviting bad press, possibly being picked up by the mainstream in that sense.
But to like, the counter argument is that like Paul Levesque is so slick when he is ever thrown like a curveball like that. Like, he's really good on his feet at these press conferences. So I don't imagine he wouldn't be able to.
It might be a bit of a self-realization that, hey, I'm really bad at these, or at least people telling him, hey, you're really bad at fielding these sort of questions, so maybe we should just not do these press conferences, period.
Paul, you're really bad. You know, that's a perfect segue into this series, because the main character of these episodes is Paul Levesque. He is the... it feels as though like Paul Levesque is now in the role, much like Vince McMahon was for a generation, in that this company cannot exist without Vince McMahon. He is the one that understands this industry, that nobody else could possibly have this genius attached to him. And now it's Paul Levesque who has the added attribute of being a former wrestler, something Vince McMahon did not have as an experience. And that Paul Levesque, he is the almighty. He is the Yoda to all of these talents that I don't even say this dismissively, though, comes across that. Like, they bow in deference to this deity that is Paul Levesque. Like, that, I don't know how you can't come to that conclusion, like, on this. Like, this is your loving father that is just dispensing wisdom at every turn while he's sipping on his cold brew.
How do you know it's cold brew? I guess it could be water, could be prime, could be a number of things.
There's nothing but ice that runs through this man.
I will have to say that does come across as a very cynical, like, way of framing it. Like, if you were to ask him, they would simply say he's the coach. He's the coach of this, like, all-star team, and he's the sort of, like, like the Christian Horner of the group, or the total wolf, of his F1 team, right? And I think that's how they might choose to maybe portray it. And another sort of comparison point, I feel very much like he's sort of the Dana White that they're trying to present attached to this company, much in the way that, the Ultimate Fighter ultimately became a vehicle for Dana White as the sort of central figure.
Yep.
Levesque is that for the WWE. It's the person that they could rely on. The company certainly is. It's in their best interest to center it around him, because there's no real danger of him leaving this group. You might cycle through your professional wrestlers, but you're not as likely to cycle through, somebody like a Paul Levesque.
We should mention showrunner for this series is Eric Powers. The director and editor is Chris Weaver. And this has to be the lengthiest credit roll we've ever got on any WWE-related production. I mean, there Mr. was an McMahon army.
Mr. McMahon had one, too, didn't
he? You're right. You're right. That was, I guess, that one, too.
It
was
like, show,
there was an army working on this show if you stuck around for the end credits. The first episode is entitled New Era.
Yeah,
the Paul Levesque era.
Let's just pause here. This is, of course, the double shot. Welcome, everybody. This is
are we rolling?
This is the show where we review just a lot of the supplementary programming attached to professional wrestling that we don't usually get to cover in sort of a deep level on our pro wrestling review shows. This is a podcast that is being released early for our patrons at postwrestlingcafe.com, which is our Patreon. This is a free sample that our free audience will be able to hear by this point, I believe, which should be Friday for most of you. But if you're enjoying the series, we're going to be talking about each episode one per week, starting with this one. So sign on at postwrestlingcafe.com if you are interested in hearing our thoughts on the rest of the series.
So tell me first about how did these episodes to you, just in tone, feel... differ from, say, a WWE 24 or some of their in-house productions? Like, this was, this was kind of, it was a collaborative effort, but this was very much, Netflix that was directing things here. How did...
Or Peyton Manning's production.
You're right. Omaha Productions, we should stipulate. How did this differ in that sense from a in-house WWE produced documentary?
The difference, I would say, primarily is that it focuses on the writing and the creation of the moment rather than the performers themselves. Almost everything we've ever seen, WWE documentary production wise has been focused on the performer, right? This is focusing on the brain trust behind the performer and the brain trust behind the crafting of these quote unquote moments, with Paul Levesque as being the central figurehead. So I would say that would be the main thing. I think certainly it does a lot more in this first episode, at least, to expose sort of the creation of pro wrestling in ways that we haven't really seen in so much of the others. Like, this whole first episode gave you a whole breakdown of, well, I guess, what the layout of a gorilla position is, or the communication between a referee and a performer and producers in gorilla position via headset. Those are sort of conversations that we've never really seen touched on in professional wrestling, or at least certainly WWE produced documentary before.
And how about straddling that line of both servicing the diehard wrestling fan and also welcoming in an audience without necessarily, turning one side off of the other? Did you feel that was a good balance?
I think, like, to appeal to the heart, like, diehard wrestling fan, maybe listeners of this particular podcast, they may have attempted to satisfy them by, again, giving some of those behind the scenes glimpses that would be very novel and of interest to anybody who's watched this for a long time that hasn't really seen it presented and exposed in a way like this from the WWE itself. But I primarily feel like that's that might be a bonus of theirs. I do think that their primary concern is to make this appealing to new audiences, audiences that, again, are tuning on Netflix, might be dismissive of just seeing all this WWE like bullshit on their Netflix suddenly. But I like reality TV. I like Drive to Survive. What is this about? Let's take a look. You know, I've seen this Rhea Ripley person on TikTok. What, like, you know, she seems to be, she's on the thumbnail. What is this? So you're clicking on it. And I think the first thing is, as we kind of saw from the Netflix debut, Paul Levesque showing up, typewriter intro, you know, really just the sort of admission that this is written. Yes, it's one of the first things people will say when they talk about professional wrestling to me, realizing that like I cover this for a living, is that that stuff's like predetermined, right? Like that stuff's not real, right? I still get that to this day, and I'm sure you do too, John. So this is directly targeting that.
Only when I do international media.
It's amazing. So this show, I think, is very much designed to target that fan to be able to tell them, yes, it's predetermined, and that's why it's awesome. You know, so it's showing you exactly what the sort of intrigue is in the creation of professional wrestling. And I think they managed to achieve that, like, even early on, first of all, by introducing the head writer of the show, Paul Levesque, centering the show around him. And then also starting us off by having Cody explain to us that his daughter looks at professional wrestling or thinks of professional wrestling like it's dance, like, you know, daddy's going to dance today. And they take that and they almost expand on it as a way to provide a framework from somebody who's new to this to think of this as more of an organized dance routine and dance recital, dance show, rather than, you know, people who actually think these people are fighting for real.
This scene was screaming for a sit down with Liberty to break down professional wrestling, and it probably would have been more advanced than a lot of people, her elders.
John, wrestling has more than one royal family, so someday I'm sure we will, on Real Season 24, maybe we'll get Liberty's reaction to this.
Yes. I would say that so it's mixed in with both like the behind the scenes nature that is, it's certainly like a sanitized version. I think the profiles that they do, especially when they're out and you're seeing, like, I thought two of the scenes that to me just came across the most genuine were seeing Cody and Cena and their interaction with their fans. And I don't care what you want to say about these people, that when they are in these situations, especially with young kids, it means a whole lot to these people, and they approach it with such a sincerity that comes across. And it would not surprise me either, because you have heard these stories about Cena that for years he never wanted any publicity for the stuff he was doing, and just having a camera here filming him, I bet you he wasn't, like, maybe he's evolved in that, or at least softened that stance, because at a time WWE did start to promote a lot of his Make-A-Wish stuff. But, and even as hot button of an issue as Hogan is, like, you can see scenes of, like, Hogan that, I mean, you can say what you will, like, that guy did an enormous amount of charity work. And I think it's something that, you know, you just watch these people and I just thought those scenes were exceptionally strong in these first couple of episodes, where you're seeing them interact and give these fans like an experience more than just a quick signature on a paper and boom, it's like a procession of fans that get no real interaction with the star.
I totally agree. Yeah, I think it's maybe on discussions like that we usually have, where we more so focus on news. This sort of thing isn't necessarily a newsworthy thing for us to discuss, and therefore it probably doesn't get enough coverage from platforms like ours. But it is an incredibly, maybe if you ask them, maybe one of the most significant parts of what they do. And obviously when you look at a Cody and a Cena, probably one of the things they're most proud of about, you know, their tasks at work, so to speak. So I think that was a very necessary and welcome sort of portion of these wrestlers' lives that they chose to expose. I also think it played a part, though, in like telling the story here. You know, this first episode talks about this person, Cody Rhodes, now trying to become the face of the company. Cody gets emotional in even just talking about that. And doing your meet and greets, doing like your Make-A-Wish sort of appearances is very much a part of that, you know, taking time out of your family, taking time out of your personal life in order to do this sort of thing is part of being the captain of this team.
This month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, we're going back to November of 1995 as Rewind Away takes a look at the Survivor Series featuring Diesel defending the WWF Championship against Bret Hart. We'll also have weekly editions of Collision Course with the carousel of co-hosts joining Kate from Montreal, reviews of TNA Victory Road, New Japan's Destruction in Kobe, and it is the Ask Away Mailbag Show as John and Wei answer your questions all this month at postwrestlingcafe.com.
So we are introduced to the brain trust of writers, including a very rare appearance by Ed Koski, who has been with this company, I'm not exaggerating, for 25 years.
Did you know what he looked like?
I'm pretty sure I've seen him before, but it's like exceptionally rare. I'm sure many people have heard the name Ed Koski. I'm sure very few have seen him before. Others that are just showing here kind of around the United Nations table here. Jonathan Beckstorm, who is the VP of Creative Writing, Michael Hayes, Alex Williams, who like a female senior writer. And, you know, how did you feel like the writing scenes came across? Because if you remember the infancy of promoting this, so much of this was about getting into the writer's room. Like, that's what this show was pretty much pitched to the public as. And I wouldn't say like that is the sole focus of this series. Like it's mixed in. Did you feel like these meetings came across as authentic? Did you feel like, how did you feel about these scenes as they were spread out?
They truly felt authentic to me. And I understand that, like, in talking about professional wrestling, especially in regards to this company, where every scene is just like sanitized and possibly like fictionalized, we should be skeptical of everything we're presented with. But I watch this and it feels very like honest to me. It feels like, I mean, I've been in a writer's room, you know, with professional wrestling, and this just looks like that. And I also don't know if like the acting is that strong from all of these guys. Now, at the same time, I'm sure all of these writers are very much aware that, hey, we're being filmed right now for a reality show. And I'm sure that might lead them to censor themselves in some ways in these sort of conversations. And even so, like, the edit will probably clean up whatever they want to clean up. But otherwise, it looks like what I would imagine exactly. Well, it is exactly what it is. Did you have any thoughts on the room? You know, like, is this in your mind how you pictured maybe a WWE writer's room to look like?
I mean, you've seen the layout before. Like, do you remember a few years ago? This was when they were still at the old headquarters, but they put out a video on the writing team, and
I don't remember this actually. But
this it was a YouTube deal, and I remember. Yeah, like it was either on the corporate site or it was a YouTube release. It might have just been on the corporate site for some deal. And it was like interviewing the writers and talking about like the process. Like, it was very non-WWE in terms of like, but yeah, it put faces to the writing staff and it showed them like in the room and such. Not to the degree these scenes were, but you got the general sense. But this was, yeah, a number of years ago that they put this out. This is the video, yes. I can't remember what year this came out, but it was several years back.
Okay, yeah. Do you feel like, any thoughts on just maybe this sort of just making the idea of like writers and a writing staff being now a thing that, you know, a WWE fan is able to consider and think about this much. Do you have any thoughts on that in comparison to maybe philosophies of the past in pro wrestling?
I mean, I get the sense of like there's like this hesitance about, oh, this series, it's like it's exposing the industry. And I just feel like I'm watching this and it was like, I think like the most casual wrestling fans know what the makeup is and how this all works. And I don't mean just like scripted, that yeah, there's a writing staff. And yes, there's like, I think the general fan knows so much of this. And I think you have a lot of talent that they grew up in an industry where they looked at it as such a segregated area that is backstage and opening that up. But it's like this series, like it's very much in tune with WWE that they are opening up a portion that there's certainly a big demand for a certain fan base to see, but they're only going so far to see things. Like you're not seeing something that is just no holds barred, that is footage that you would not think WWE would want out there. Like this feels like a very curated presentation of WWE that takes you behind the scenes, but in a very glowing sense of look how this works. Look how we look how the sausage is made to a certain degree.
Yeah, I believe, you know, in order to perhaps I think they're using this to help legitimize what they do, you know, to
very much so, very much so.
Audience. I mean, they want to be not compared necessarily to, like, I don't know, your idea of professional wrestling from like the 80s or just like the sort of layman's perception of what professional wrestling is. They want to be compared to Friends and Seinfeld and, like, you know, Saturday Night Live and like shows that have actual production attached to it. And I think that is the trade-off that they're happy to exchange in exchange for, like, you know, breaking kayfabe, for instance. There's also the, I think, other element of like being able to use this now in order to, as a tool for them to play with the sort of reality that a modern wrestling fan might have, thinking that they might know how this stuff is made. Well, now we can let you think you know how it's made, and now we can use this to tell our stories. So it's very much like, I think, a sort of them trying to get ahead of maybe what a modern wrestling fan has sort of found out about wrestling.
Yeah, and like we'll talk about this later in the series about like the John Cena heel turn, but it seems like the new thing is when we have something that's like a state secret that only the select few will know. And then you have a series like this that you can roll it out. And we know that there was footage being shot over the weekend at SummerSlam. I have no doubt that like the Seth Rollins and Brock Lesnar stories like are going to flow into that of like, here are these closely guarded secrets. And now on our terms, on our Netflix series, we're going to let you in and tell you how that was all devised in our telling of that story, whether accurate or not.
The Rollins one, for sure. That'll be its own episode. The Brock one, I wonder how much detail, though. Well, how much detail will they get into?
It's time to go home. It's time to come home.
Yeah.
It's time to come home, Brock. He had just wandered out into the wild. No lawsuits.
The idea that, like... yeah, like I expect very much that whole scene to maybe even make its way into Unreal. The fact that like we might get that in Unreal might give a bit more of an explanation for why we had that weird Michael Cole explanation on Monday.
Yeah, maybe we'll get his sit down interview with Nick Khan and Paul Levesque on Unreal.
Maybe.
So the first episode, as Wade had mentioned, it's focused on the debut on Netflix back in January. And we get kind of snapshots of Rhea Ripley at her home in Florida. No sign of a spouse, a partner. I assume she lives alone with her three dogs.
Three dogs, and that's,
yes,
about it.
No, she doesn't have any friends, no buddies, just dogs. And
shrunken hands and a lot of taxidermy.
Yeah, she's into taxidermy. She talked about, like, having a tryout at WWE at 17 and then being told she was too young, and then did another when she was 20. And I had never heard this before, that she took Ripley from Sigourney Weaver's character in Alien.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. And Rhea from A Goddess's Name?
Yes.
So they do key her as her real name, her government name, which I think everyone
had to say their subject. Real name, their ring name, and their government name.
Yeah, which is the term that every wrestler or performer had to clarify.
Yeah.
Demidi?
Yeah. Demi? I mean, she largely, I think, just went by Demi. Yeah, Demita.
Demita.
Yeah.
Okay.
I remember when I heard the, like, government name being used over and over again. I mean, a number of years ago, I interviewed Big E.
Yeah,
and he was one where, like, I really didn't know how to introduce him. Like, I felt kind of silly, like, introducing him as Big E. And you also have to, like, you have to call up the person and say, hi, is this a Big E on the phone? Mm-hmm. So we started the interview, and I introduced him as Ettore Yuen. He's like, whoa. Using my government name here, and that's which I got.
It's odd. It's odd to introduce somebody as a real name in wrestling.
Okay. Like, there's some names that you would be like, okay, it's like his name is not really Seth Rollins, but it's okay. He's like
sounds
Seth
real
is,
enough.
You sound kind of silly trying to go and hey Colby, but then there's others like Hi Raven. You know what I mean?
It's not that odd to me just as a wrestling fan, but I do know what you mean, like in real life.
Yeah.
But I mean, listen, like who calls the Undertaker Mark, right? Like he's the Undertaker everywhere, isn't he? And that, and you can't get a more ridiculous name than that.
Yeah. So, we do the profile of Rhea Ripley, and then they go through like the injury that she sustained with Liv Morgan backstage and opting to go without surgery, and therefore, you know, she sounds like she'll eventually need surgery on this shoulder. It felt like one of those like Christopher Daniels deals where he just like forever had this like lump on his shoulder for the rest of his career afterward and just didn't want to take that amount of time out, although she was gone for several months as well.
I found it interesting. Well, first of all, it was interesting seeing her immediate reaction footage, like appear in the trainer's room after this very significant real life injury from that scene. We also got a little scene of like, I think Levesque coaching Rhea on the actual scene itself without obviously knowing that it would turn into a real life injury. She also let on that like she doesn't think that her relationship with Dom was initially supposed to be a romantic one. And I guess we can assume maybe a lot of that was just either decided upon later or maybe dictated by an audience through the whole.
Like, it really wasn't until the Liv stuff that it's not like they did scenes with the two of them where it was designed to be a relationship. Like, it was implied. I think it was always implied.
Well, the whole mommy thing kind of made it pretty clear.
I mean, they treaded that line, but it seemed as though they didn't want to make it just so explicit until there was a reason to with the Liv story as well.
Sure.
Then there was a big focus on the return of CM Punk to the company, a.k.a. Black Phillip, Pepsi Phil, Cookie Monster, Punker, CM Punk, Phil Brooks, who he notes, my real name, it's a white accountant's name.
Phil Brooks, I guess, yeah, it would be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Brooks, and Brooks LLC.
Black Phil? Is that
Black Phillip?
Black Phillip.
Yeah, I don't know if that one really took off. Yeah. Yeah. So we get the dynamic here of him and Paul Levesque as adversaries, as performers, and then coming back together where, you know, Paul had said, you know, even years after he left, we talked about him coming back, and I said, same guy. Won't work.
In your mind, do you know what the timeline of that may have been? Like,
I mean, Punk comes, he starts doing backstage in 2019, mm-hmm. and that's with FS1. Mm-hmm. But, you know, from the, you know, and Punk has recently spoken about this, about different times that they had talked, and it always sounded as though it was like Vince McMahon was just not interested in working with Punk again for whatever reason. And then we had the situation, let's remember, right before Collision, that Punk goes to their show in Chicago reportedly was asked to leave the arena as well. Mm-hmm. Then goes, does Collision, has the forgotten Summer of Punk that culminates at Wembley with Jack Perry. And then it is the season fall of Punk as he returns to WWE in 2023. And they put out this goofy picture.
Yes. Okay. So... yeah, we get a little bit of like, I think their present day interpretation of their relationship.
Whether you agree with it or not, the narrative now that is endorsed pretty much by Punk is, I was an angry person, I was bitter, and the WWE has welcomed me back. Like, that is kind of the story that they now push. It's not so much, but Punk has always maintained and does in this series the fact that like, I needed to leave this company or I was going to die. Mm-hmm. And I think if you listen to this guy at the time, I don't know how much of an exaggeration that is. This was a guy that was absolutely destroying himself and seemed like he was just mentally fried, physically destroyed, and was on this never-ending hamster wheel with the company. But, you know, omitted from all of this is, you know, being fired on his wedding day, which, let's remember that, he... has a royalty check that he finds, contacts the office about. Paul calls him back, and it's Punk that mentions to Paul on the phone, I'm getting married this weekend. Let's talk as soon as I'm back from my honeymoon. Mm. And then the FedEx arrives on his wedding day, alerting him of his firing. That is not part of the redemption story, or just chalked up to an amazing coincidence that Paul learned about his wedding day, and it just so happened that his firing, that he was issued his release by notification on the day of his wedding.
Nor the Chris Amon lawsuit, nor the, undiagnosed staff infection.
Oh, yeah. And things the like company that. Posting, like, on their website, like, the photos of Brooks, like, lower back to try and discredit his accusation that he had a giant lump when the lump was actually on his ass and not on his belt line.
But it also wasn't the focus of the story.
You know? No, it's not. I'm just saying in general, though, like... Like, let's always watch this through this prism, and I'm not even saying it on real, but on WWE programming. Like, that is, that's not their job to have to document all this, but I do feel it is kind of on ours to contextualize that this is kind of the sanding of those edges to make this a much more happy, prodigal son coming home story.
In short, it was complicated. Right. And like the way they basically the way they deduced it in this, like, whatever, like 50-second, you know, explanation of their relationship is that Punk and Triple H both came up at a time where they were rivals competing for a top spot. And once Triple H transferred over to, like, middle management, Punk was very resentful of it and did not want to take it, a direction from somebody he still saw as a competitor. That led to resentment from both sides, distrust from both sides, eventually
leading to Punk on that pay-per-view when you could argue Punk was at his hottest, and that was part of his, like, meeting with Vince and Paul when he walked out in 2014 was, like, that was clearly something that stuck with Punk, was that I needed that, and you just beat me on that pay-per-view when you totally didn't need it at that time. You know, there's just all that aspect. All that is to say is that the way it is presented now, it's like how much Phil has matured and grown up. And believe me, there's a lot we have documented heavily on, like, the negative elements of Punk. There are also a lot of justifications. Like, this is not one-sided, and I think Punk had a lot of reasoning for leaving this company and reason to harbor any ill feelings. But we're at a stage where it is best for both sides to be on this page, and that's how it's presented here.
Yeah, and I guess, like, part of the maturation is being willing to listen to Paul Levesque and to, I guess, in their minds, in their sort of interpretation, I guess, being able to work together to create rather than butting heads.
One of the other aspects I found that they place a lot of attention on is just, like, you can look at it this two ways, and I don't think one is necessarily better than the other, because I can make arguments for both, but, like, right down to they're holding this Netflix promotional event at WWE headquarters, and you've got Alex Williams, who's one of the writers, like, literally with Punk, and they're going over how this physical interaction with Rollins is going to go. And, like, it just tells you the level of, I don't want to call it micromanaging, but, like, it just feels as though, like, the level of leeway for improv just comes across as so, so minimal. And that's such a far cry. I can imagine a lot of, like, veteran wrestlers that would just look at the level of planning and detail that is so foreign to the industry they were part of. And you could certainly argue that at this level, where it is, whether it's live television or a pay-per-view, it requires that detail. Some may argue with that, but even something as, like, this promotional event where it's like, you guys are going to come out and you're going to have you're just going to have an argument to promote. Like, even that is just so detailed in how they are laying things out. Like, it really does give you a glimpse. And again, like, I think to the common person, they'll look at that and be like, wow, this is so cool how this is all so planned out. But I think for others, like, it does just show you, like, how managed it is.
It certainly goes against, I think, what wrestling has traditionally been, you know, before this sort of, like having to produce maybe as much media as it's required to, and media that is that needs to go to a certain time. What's interesting is that this episode eventually culminates with a big discussion about a segment going over time involving these two. So, I mean, it completely is, I think, a very different pro wrestling world from what it was before when you're having to hit time cues as hard as they are. You can make the argument that I think a lot of performers might prefer this. And certainly, especially in the case of a Phil Brooks, this sort of micromanaging of even a talking segment like this is probably something they really, really, really needed or at least wanted to count on because of things like the workers' rights promo and things that have gone off track without these sort of like, you know, carefully dictated beats.
We will get into it later in the series of like the they will profile like the Charlotte Flair Tiffany Stratton segment for instance as well. And like that's another part, and it's good that you bring up the workers' rights thing, is that, you know, generally, like as an observer, you look at the fact that you want to have an organic presentation, and sometimes that leaves you just send people out there and maybe it's like bullet points or something and you let them just be in the moment. Sometimes we don't appreciate that some of these lines that you react to, if these performers are not ready for them, we have seen a lot of performers that do not respond well. And this is maybe the cardinal example of that of the last number of years. But you also have the Charlotte Flair one from Tiffany Stratton earlier, which, again, for business, it ended up being great. But it also like created like this mistrust in the moment and what was an issue. So there's that aspect. It's like you're trying to cut these scathing promos that are going to hit close to the bone for maximum reaction, but you got to still be working with your partner here. And you know, you can have like, these are still human, these are combustible elements in human form here. Like, these are not robots that are out there delivering lines to each other.
I mean, dating back to like, you know, Sean and Brett and all of their interactions on screen, I think like this one of the most fascinating elements of what professional wrestling is.
And it was amazing television. And those guys were throwing like heavy heaters at one another. And I'm sure that the other was, you know, we know for a fact, like the Sunny Days comment, like that was one that was not expected and had significant impact on Brett's personal life.
This sort of balancing between reality and fiction is exactly like what draws us diehard fans to professional wrestling that much more. And I think it's this sort of like element and engagement with what this is that I think they want to try to convey to a wider audience through something like an Unreal. Not to say that this segment had anything to do with that. We just kind of got off on a bit of a tangent about scripted.
No, but it's something that's going to be recurring throughout the series, is just the level of planning and memorization. That will come up.
Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chalk Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MC Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. That's chop-tees.com/post-wrestling.
Right. Then we had the big breakdown way of the gorilla position, which to my recollection of all the seasons of Drive to Survive, I've never seen the paddock broken down quite like this.
they should. They never really kind of played with this sort of like graphical, like, you know, element nearly.
They had some very cool production stuff here. Like, you have these like videos of gorilla that are on the floor as they're doing a time lapse of the construction of the gorilla position. And we'll save this for the next episode, but one of their I don't even want to call it a camera technique, but through the transitions of the rumble, like they had some like A1 production that I found to be super cool in this. Like, it was a very, very high level produced series.
Yeah, I'm such a nerd for like, you know, like graphics and things like this. And like something like this, I guess doesn't really like, it's not like it's breaking any sort of ground.
This looks like we're watching one of those like true crime series on Netflix. Like,
we know what gorilla position is, but it's this sort of like polish that I think like makes it feel like it's a big production, and I'm sure to the layman they might find some sort of interesting appeal. So the gorilla position is something that is custom built at any venue that they're at, and you saw this great time lapse of them putting the walls up, and it usually consists of three tables, one involving Levesque and I guess whoever else.
Station with Pritchard, and then you have Billy Kidman timing out the show with the match producers, and that's where we are. You know, they have a flowing series of producers. Like, you see Chris Park a.k.a. Abyss, Bobby Roode, Nick Aldis, Michael Hayes, Petey Williams, Jason Jordan, like Adam Pearce, like they all get like FaceTime here. But
so it's really quite, I would say, a contrast from like previous years where we wouldn't even get the names of like referees. You know, they were trying to make the referees just this sort of like generic role. Now, like they're essentially kind of making every person back there into its own character. You know, in my opinion, I think Chris Park, Abyss was one of the highlights of this particular show.
No, he was the highlight of this for me. Yeah. Okay. He was amazing.
Yeah. Like these now are kind of, you know, they're becoming recognizable names as a result, or potentially as a result of this feature.
And that's another aspect. And this maybe goes more so toward like the talent and the actual staff, but this is like the most harmonious environment. Like, yes, it is stressful, as we will get into, but overall, you have Paul Levesque that is this like soothing force that's congratulating the performers.
Head coach.
Exactly. Head coach.
Bad head coach.
Lots of one-on-one time. Yeah. And to me, it's like, this is the antithesis of every moment you have heard of with Vince McMahon. Like, let's remember that 365 series, and Kevin Owens gets back from WrestleMania and he goes up to Vince, and Vince is just appalled at the match he has just seen with Jericho, and it's this hugely negative moment for Kevin Owens. And I'm sure
Vince had his like moments of congratulation.
He absolutely did. You just can't paint it as all bad, but I will say, like, this is Paul Levesque being presented in like the best light here, that if you were to see this guy blow a gasket, I don't think we're seeing it in this series. And with Vince McMahon, I think you'd have some really compelling television if you had that level of access, where I think you would get a much more animated kind of lead overseer in Vince McMahon.
I guess I would be very curious to hear about like a wrestler comparing the sort of management styles of both a McMahon and also a Paul Levesque. And I guess maybe we could say through parenthood, Paul Levesque is a gentle parent. Okay, he's into gentle parenting. He's into, like, you know, complimenting, maybe compliment sandwiches. You're doing this very well, but you could afford to do this better. But whereas Vince might be a bit more of an old school, like, you're sitting in timeout. Think about what you did wrong. I'm very ashamed of you. I will not love you until you do this.
And I think as well, like, you have the fact that, you know, number one, for a lot of these performers, like for most of them, there's at least a generation gap now that they came up watching this guy on television. And for all of them, they have, like, Paul Levesque has the background. He was one of the talents. He was on the road. He does have that understanding that a Vince McMahon, as much as attached as he was not the guy that was on the road making all of the towns and having that in common with all of these. And there was even a further divide among, you know, the age gap that Vince McMahon would have with a lot of these talents over the last number of years as well. And I'm certain that is, like, I think generally, like, you only have to read between the lines of so many of these performers that talk so glowingly about where things are now compared to where they were in the past. And I don't think that's just, you know, shining a light on Paul Levesque because that's their current situation. I think that that's rooted in a lot of real feelings for those that have the contrast.
No doubt. In Levesque's situation, I feel like he's very much been building up to this, like, for years, you know, ever since the days of NXT. Like, what is the purpose of a Paul Levesque pointing photo? You know, it's okay, one, maybe to give a seal of approval to whatever talents that he's choosing to, you know, put the belt on. It's also to promote himself and to establish continually that he is the person who created this. He's the person responsible. This is his signature. His name tag is on this Rhea Ripley run. Sasha Banks, you know, winning the NXT championship. Sasha and Bayley. I'm going to put my stamp of approval on it, put my face out there. So this series very much just kind of feels like a culmination of Levesque's just, like, I would say, decade-long desire to just, like, want to be seen as the creative mind behind all of this stuff.
Very, right? Very different from Vince McMahon.
Yeah.
Like, don't mention me during the Hall of Fame. Like, you're not seeing any of this. Vince was the guy who, for years, like, wanted to write himself off of television. Like, it was, you know, he had that understanding. It's like, I should not be on television. That's why you got, like, the limousine blowing up and, like, these angles that were designed like that would be the end of the McMahon character. Like, that's, it's a very different perspective that the two have showcased.
Let me ask you this question. So we see many scenes of, like, you know, like Rhea Ripley. Part of the big story about this episode is just kind of the anxiety that she deals with, you know, and how, like, we see on that Netflix special, she's in the back, she's nervous, having a great breakdown. I thought a great scene with Damien Priest consoling her and just basically kind of like truly being a terror twin, all right? A good terror twin. By listening and just, like, going through her matches, giving her advice, telling her to, like, hey, like, you might have to cut this down. Great scene with her. And then, like, a whole lot of her talking to Levesque and, like, basically, you know, being happy to have Levesque's approval. We see it later in the series with, like, Jey Uso having a similar sort of interaction with Levesque. Do you think it diminishes the star power at all of these performers? Essentially, like, now being seen as, like, rather than these sort of, like, superhero characters, they are maybe pieces, or at least, like,
I understand what you mean. I understand what you mean. Yeah. I think that that's, like, there's some of that, but, I mean, the proof is also in the pudding that a lot of these people, like, they are seen as major stars to the audience, but it's a very different, it's just such a different makeup of, like, the industry, where you had, like, these people that were generally, you know, these were, you know, going back decades, like, independent contractors, that it was the feel of, you are lucky to have me here. And it's more so, and this is not across the board, but
they held the cards, they were bringing something to the table.
And whereas, if I'm not happy here, I can go to the next territory, right, or that type of deal. Like, I know what my worth is, what I'm bringing here. And I don't doubt there's many that would understand that their worth today, especially your top end guys, but there's also, like, a I'm lucky to be here. And
now, yeah,
because let's look at it, like, yes, there is AEW, of course, and that's a big difference, but you take out an AEW and there's only so many spots there. Like, you leave WWE, it's a major gap between WWE and even to, like, your TNA level or a New Japan or going to Mexico or the independents, that a lot of these performers, it's like, yeah, if you are not one of the few that an AEW would be interested in, like, there's nowhere close that you're going to be making, like, this kind of a living in WWE. And that's, and that's been bred throughout a whole, you know, post WCW environment.
It's just very still fascinating to me that, like, in a business where, like, you are trying your hardest to make these people feel like the biggest stars that they can be, I do wonder if this is, it presents some sort of, like, real counter to it, in essentially showing them as puppets of a mastermind rather than, you know, individuals who have got there themselves based on their own merit.
No, it's an interesting, like, look at it that some may take away from that as well. Like, this series, like, two episodes in, like, this is, like, Paul Levesque is the mastermind. Like, that is very clear. He is your Dana White on Ultimate Fighter. And more so because...
More so than that.
Dana White is just, like,
control.
Yeah, like, he... Like, it's... This is the guy orchestrating everything, including, like, the match outcomes and where we're going. Like, it's much more storytelling than, like... Whereas, you know, Dana White is, like, the head cheerleader and the guy that ultimately runs the company on Ultimate Fighter. So, the backstage... The final piece is the Netflix debut at the Intuit Dome, and we see, like, shots of The Rock appearing to start the show. Rhea Ripley, who, like, literally calls it like she was having an anxiety attack before her match with Liv Morgan.
It was clear that the performers were, I mean, as we all were. Like,
oh, that was a massive show. Massive show.
Felt like a WrestleMania to a lot
more people have watched that show than any WrestleMania this year, either night, more than the Royal Rumble. Like, that is the high benchmark that I don't know when another WWE show will hit that level, because the promotion was immense for that show, and it was the peak of the curiosity going into the debut. But then the focus is the main event with Punk and Seth Rollins, and this is where we get Chris Park, not to be confused with his legal brethren.
Government name.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Chris Park. My on-screen name was Abyss, and Joseph Park, and my government name. I also wrestled in Puerto Rico. This guy was amazing. And oh, so it was only accentuated by like the story, like this is this guy in the flesh when he is producing these matches. And
if there was any like question of how much of a leap Joseph Park was for this person to perform, I mean, you kind of got your answer here. Oh. He is Joseph Park in real life.
Like seriously, this guy would be a he was like when he did that shift to Joseph Park.
Yeah.
He was so great as a performer, and that was, you know, really just him dialing up his own self. Yep. And I think this guy would be an amazing GM if they ever wanted to go that direction on either show.
It would be a very different type of GM than an Aldis or Pierce, who are very much in control. Like the appeal,
this guy would have more character to him, but he could also play with the dial too. Like this guy has a lot of range that I think if you did ever need someone in a pinch. I think that there is a lot. I found him so compelling here.
For people who, never watched TNA during Joseph Park or didn't watch this episode of Unreal, like, think of big, giant man, okay, who is about as fidgety and nervous and stressed out all the time and as maybe even insecure as you can imagine. Like, think about, like, an incredibly terrified little person inside the body of a big, giant monster abyss. And that's what you get in Chris Park, and it was greatly sort of told in this final scene.
So the problem is, as they describe it, that Punk and Rollins went, quote, way long, and Park is freaking out, and he's apologizing on the spot to Bruce Pritchard, who's kind of like just, okay, well, it's going long. And Bruce Pritchard states on camera that all these people thought we're on Netflix. We can go 2 hours. We can go 4 hours. Not true. And so we're watching this.
He doesn't exactly give like a real explanation.
No, he doesn't.
Why,
nor does it add up to what we have seen on Netflix. So number one is this show. I remember it very distinctly. It went like 3 hours on the dot. Okay. So it went 3 hours. It's not like it went 3 hours and 7 minutes. It's not like it went 2 hours and 40 minutes. It went 3 hours on the dot. So are you telling me that this was scheduled to be 2 hours and 52 minutes? And plus, like literally this week on Monday, Raw ended at, I want to say like 10:38 p.m. They went over the 10:30 is generally when it ends on the dot. And like they didn't explain like there's any international markets where they don't have Netflix that we've got to end it here. I don't believe that's even like the case.
I mean, eventually there is, I think, like a perceived like time limit where I think things are just too long, and he like Pritchard could have just simply been speaking about just this show feeling too long and that it was a drag and that it was no longer compelling. Like they could have gotten to the point where even before the Punk Rollins match, this show, because of the Rock segment, because of like whatever other segments were, they were already so long that this match going over its allotted time limit was becoming a problem,
because the match goes 18 minutes, but again, like they're off right at 3 hours. And then after like Pritchard makes this stance, like that's not true. We have to end by this time. At the end of it, Park is just so apologetic. He's like, we cut this out. And Pritchard's like, it's fine. It's TV.
Well, no. Pritchard actually said it was overproduced. It was overbooked. What were his exact words here?
I don't have the exact wording here, but it's like there was no consequence to this. It's not like there was some.
Pritchard was criticizing it, like he was saying, like it almost felt like he said it was overwritten, overproduced. It was over everything else. It's fine. It was a great show. That maybe almost as if to say, like, it's over. We can't do anything about it. You know, if we wanted to do something about it, we should have fixed it before going out there and writing as much as we were. That almost felt like just his way of consoling a guy who was clearly very upset in Chris Park about it.
Yeah.
But I don't think he was trying to convey that he was happy. In fact, like Chris Park right afterwards is talking to Regal. Regal is having to console Chris Park and having to tell him, hey, like, it's fine. Be proud of yourself. And Chris Park is like,
I'm just trying to make this guy happy. I'm just trying to do the job.
You think he's mad at me? Like, he's amazing.
He was very amusing. He was amazing. Here. And, like, if you didn't know any better, you would think this guy is the ultimate worker here on camera. But dude, this was Joseph Park, and it was.
I've been backstage, like in a situation with him doing this sort of thing as part of like a TNA thing. he's exactly this person. He's this nervous. He's a wreck. And like, and I'm sure he's also very effective as a result. Maybe like people like working with him because he cares so much about this, but he's also just clearly somebody who probably could chill out a little bit, you know, in how hard he is on himself.
All that is to say, this is not like the case of Bill Goldberg's retirement speech being cut off because we have a legit hard out on network television. And right. That's what I came out at the end of this. It was like, it was an 18-minute match. I went back to check. And like for your main event, this big grudge match that they had built up for the debut on Netflix, like what was this supposed to be, like 10 minutes in a cage? Like, well, I imagine like that's the time you would have thought that this would be allotted.
The problem is the show is already so long in itself, right? And there was, I think at that point, a real qualitative sort of like reasoning to cut things or to at least make sure that at the very least you're hitting to time what you wanted. And I'm assuming 15 was what they were allotted.
So you think they would have been out at like 2 hours and 45 minutes instead of 3 hours?
If all things went perfectly, maybe, you know. But again, we don't know exactly what was overtime. I'm assuming it was The Rock that, yeah, that probably threw everything off, you know, at the beginning.
Well, there you go. That was episode one. Final thoughts just on the first episode. Did this grab you to be interested in the forthcoming four episodes?
Let me just say, I found it very fascinating how, like, in the lead up to the Punk Rollins match, it was all focused on Punk and how, like, you know, even CM Punk, like, admitting, like, when we think of CM Punk, we think of, like, the most confident professional wrestler there ever is, right? Overconfident, you can even say. But he even admits to himself that, like, before the Netflix thing, he's now suffering a lot from what he's terming as what?
Anticipatory anxiety.
Yeah, yeah. So even CM Punk was really nervous ahead of this. So the whole focus was on, like, you know, CM Punk, is he going to do this? Is he going to achieve this thing and overcome his anxiety? And then immediately the shift becomes, they're way over time and Chris Park is freaking out. How is this production going to fix itself with them going over time? And then after the match, it immediately shifts back to like Punk high-fiving people and like doing a good job. So I found that really fascinating because I imagine Punk rewatching this, if he ever watches Unreal, probably didn't realize that the story of this match wasn't going to be about him killing it in this match with Rollins, but it was about him going over time. And so I found that very interesting. I'll say, like, if it wasn't for Chris Park and the decision to edit that into the retelling of this match, I think this would have been a very generic sort of like, here's what happened at the Netflix special and everybody did well and it's a happily ever after type of story. The fact that they were willing to show this sort of wrinkle in the production of it and like the sort of imperfection of the show not being to time and having Pritchard essentially just like criticize it on camera, I actually found really refreshing and it kind of made the segment for me. So
I think it gave enough for people that were kind of seeking that out that you get a little peek into everything while it's very much on sort of like their terms. Because what was the biggest like mainstream story after this show at the Intuit Dome? He was not shown at all here, or at least not focused on, and that was the Hogan segment. Like that 100%. Was what every sports site, every entertainment site, Entertainment Tonight, everyone focused on Hogan being booed. And imagagine the timing if that had decided to be focused on in episode one here. But the story of that first episode if you watch all the coverage coming out of it.
The two most interesting things, yes, number one by far, the Hogan reaction, and number two, whatever Dwayne was doing with Cody, like that bizarre, you know, let's have a shot of vodka type of like killing of their storyline. And yeah, none of that received coverage. This show is never one I expected to like have a completely honest like view of like what was the most newsworthy thing about it. I mean, this is very much, it's a promotional vehicle ultimately for the WWE, the way a Drive to Survive is meant to be for F1, right? But I found it very, I enjoyed the episode. I thought like it provided a good sort of introduction in a different way to professional wrestling for somebody who might not usually watch professional wrestling. I thought it did a real good job of that. And it managed to do that by showing you enough of the backstage behind the scenes things that we haven't really seen before. Just even as a longtime fan, I found it very novel to see a lot of what was presented here. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I found episode one, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. I felt there was more to discuss out of this one than what we're about to discuss. I'm doing a really horrible job of promoting people to continue on this, but I'm sure we'll find some interesting aspects for episode two.
Episode two is not nearly as as interesting.
No, this was sort of like the introduction. I was more interested in just kind of the like the structure, who was going to be focused upon, like a lot of the details, like Brandon and I had like reported and such, but actually seeing, like, we had not seen the episodes, obviously, so actually seeing it, I think generally to what who they are trying to cater to, I would think like they would walk away with this fairly satisfied with it, and I would say even your diehard fan, I think it'd be enough. But I didn't watch this and feel, man, this is going to be a game changer for WWE. And maybe I'm wrong, because some, like, Drive to Survive was not this instant hit. It was like years later that it, during the pandemic, that everyone found this series. So I don't want to just completely dismiss this, because some things just catch on like a phenomenon, and on Netflix, like it's on your viewers' like time schedule to when they find a series, and if it, you know, grows its audience. That's the goal of this. I don't know if it's going to achieve that or not.
Yeah, I don't know either. It's hard for me to say, because we're
not week really... one. Certainly it's not like it felt like this was this phenomenon last week and everyone's talking about it.
Yeah, we're not really fans in those that they're trying to cater towards. But like, to me, like, I try to take my own experience with Drive to Survive as some sort of like maybe comparison point. And for me, what made Drive to Survive work was the fact that it managed to make the appeal of F1, which prior to Drive to Survive felt like a very foreign sport to me. It made it feel relatable, and it made it feel human. It's a competition between 20 people, well, people looking for 20 spots, and two people on a particular team that are actual, you know, rivals with each other. Like, all of those things. I thought it managed to do well. In the same way that I felt like this first episode managed to explain a lot of what we find appealing about professional wrestling, it managed to convey that, I thought, in a pretty decent way for a new audience.
What was your Gunther Steiner rating of this show, Way? How many, on a scale of 1 to 10?
How many wankers? Was there a Gunther Steiner on the show? Okay.
I didn't see Gunther. Ask. Oh, we did see Gunther.
No. I'm saying if there's a Gunther equivalent. If there was, it was Chris Park. He is this episode's Gunther Steiner.
Yeah, very different from Gunther Steiner, but in terms of a breakout personality, it was definitely Chris Park. And I wouldn't even say there was like a close second, to be quite honest, in terms of someone that could just be, have his own kind of unique fandom coming out of a series.
Like, he could write a book coming off of this, okay? If he loses his job for whatever reason in the WWE, he could write a book, transition to maybe public speaking, and maybe an on-air correspondent role. He'll have a second career potentially if they continue to feature him like this.
All right. So episode 2, we will be reviewing next Tuesday. You will have to be a member of the Post Wrestling Cafe, and you can do so by heading over to postwrestlingcafe.com. You can jump on board for $6, and that gets you all of our Unreal reviews, as well a new Rewind Away that just dropped this week, and my award-winning Post Profile, The Story of Hulk Hogan, which is now available as well for all at postwrestling.com. But it's a great investment in post wrestling, as we are always working on those margins. And you can support the cafe again, postwrestlingcafe.com. And each Tuesday we'll be releasing new reviews of Unreal, providing Way continues to have an affinity for watching these shows.
Yeah, we'll see this through. Those of you who may not have listened to any of this before, we also, of course, have our Mr. McMahon reviews that are up there as well. Those are also exclusive to Post Wrestling Cafe patrons. So you can dig back into the archive for our 7 years, and you can get any bonus show that we've ever done just with one month's subscription.
Premium content, and it must be premium.
Okay.
On that note, we will say goodbye. And hey, everyone, 20K. Mm-hmm.
Weight loss solutions are not one size fits all. Hers makes it simpler to get started and stick with a weight loss plan backed by expert guided online care that puts your weight loss goals first. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you. you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
This month at postwrestlingcafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. Postwrestlingcafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.